everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the horrid halls of academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
And we are back. It is February. It is cold. Toronto has experienced a rash of deep freeze, deep snow days. And this is actually a rescheduled recording because last week you were sick.
I was sick.
So I'm extra super paranoid.
I'm not sick. I'm fine. I'm me. What are you saying?
Why did you lock the doors when I came in?
Oh, did I?
And if you haven't already picked up on it, we are talking about John Carpenter's 1982 film, The Thing. And this is a film I don't remember the first time I saw it. I feel like maybe late high school, early university, but this has felt like a film that has been part of my consciousness for so long.
Yeah. I remember the first time I saw it because I had a friend in Ottawa and we were like, you know, there's a lot of horror movies that I haven't seen that I need to. Let's just plow through our list. And The Thing was at the top of our list. We hadn't seen it. So we watched it together and we were like, holy shit. How is everybody not talking about this all the time? And that was before I was really in the horror community per se, both online and professionally. And it is talked about all the fucking time. It is a universally loved film. It wasn't always the case, which I'm sure we're going to get into. But I feel a special kinship with this film. It came out in January 1982. I came out in January 1982. I like to think I'm the second best thing after this film to have happened in that time.
Well, you're at least a woman, which this film does not have.
That is something that this film does not have and maybe doesn't need. But we'll talk about that too.
We will. And I think a lot of what kind of draws people into the film is not only the caliber of the creators behind this film, like John Carpenter and also Kurt Russell as your star, but also the kind of dichotomy between these beautiful, austere shots of like snowy Antarctica and like this kind of cinematography which feels so grand and big, and then the pure, disgusting, visceral horror, the body horror that comes out of it. So the kind of balance between those two, mixed with a really great script by Bill Lancaster, Burt Lancaster's son, is amazing.
Yeah, the score is also excellent. I love how this film knows when to be bombastic and when to be very quiet for those of us who live in really snowy climates. You know that the snow has a really dampening effect. It almost has a really, even if it's just on the ground, it's very claustrophobic. It's very limiting, and it comes through in this film beautifully.
There's always a sense I get around winter when, especially when there's snow on the ground, and we get some years in Toronto where there's not a lot of snow, some years where there's a lot. There's a lot this year.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, if I'm walking down the street, especially at night, and you just hear your own kind of crunch, 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 and then you hear another, like, set of feet that go crunch, crunch, crunch behind you,
mm-hmm.
It always just, like, I always have to be like, no, it's probably just some person walking around this major city I live in. But I'm always like, oh, it's probably The Thing.
Well, without further ado, let's get into John Carpenter's 1982 film, The Thing.
Twelve men have just discovered something. For 100,000 years, it was buried in the snow and ice. Now it has found a place to live. Inside. Where no one can see it. Or hear it. Or feel it.
I know I'm human. Some of you are still human. This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation. It'll fight if it has to. But it's vulnerable out in the open. If it takes us over, then it has no more enemies. Nobody left to kill it. And then it's won.
You guys gonna listen to Gary? He can beat one of those things!
An American team stationed in Antarctica witnesses a Norwegian pilot chasing a husky with a rifle and blowing up his helicopter before accidentally shooting one of the crew. Alarmed and unable to understand the Norwegian, a member of the American team shoots him dead, and the group sets off to investigate what happened. They find the burned remains of a malformed humanoid corpse, which they return to the American station to study, finding only normal human organs. They put the wolfhound in with the rest of their snow dogs, whereupon it starts to mutate into a tentacled monster and kill the rest of the pack. The American team destroys the creature and ascertains that they're dealing with a presumably alien organism that's able to perfectly imitate other organisms. Upon investigating the Norwegian compound, they recover an excavation site and data describing the discovery of a flying saucer. Now convinced that an alien life form has infiltrated their crew and is able to mimic them perfectly, Dr. Blair flips out and destroys the helicopter and the radio. They isolate him in the shed, but not before he warns them that a mimic is in their midst. The rest of the American team, led by pilot R.J. McCready, try to determine who among them has been infected while also trying to contain the invasion from spreading to the rest of humanity. Tensions escalate accordingly, equipment is sabotaged, people die and transform in spectacular fashion, leaving only McCready and one other crew member, Childs, alone at the burning outpost, waiting to see what happens next. Now that's a really, really nutshell explanation. One of the things I love about this film is its pace. It sets off at a breakneck pace and the tension never really lets up. Obviously, there are lots of ins and outs of the plot. So-and-so does this, so-and-so does that. This group is under suspicion and this group isn't. And I have to say that for all the times that I've seen this film, I've never really, really kept track of who might be thing and who might be human, because who cares?
It's so much more fun just to go on the ride. I mean, there are a bunch of YouTube videos, which I think we'll talk about a bit later on, that kind of break down who does what and when and how. And it's kind of like Clue. Like, there's a bunch of different ways it could have all worked out. And to that point, one of the things I really love about this movie is that in the few establishing incidents of like, okay, this is an horrifying alien life form, and B, it can also take on a human form. Basically, the whole gang is there to witness it. Mm-hmm. There's no like, oh my God, Blair, did you know X, Y, and Z happened? It's like, no, it's they all witness it. So there's no to-ing and fro-ing about, you know, not being of sound mind or, you know, questioning, reasoning and all of these things. It's like, no, this is this horrifying thing that we are all confronted with, and we are confronted with it with no outside support.
That's right. And equally chilling is the fact that someone who's infected might not know they're infected. They'll deny it, and that might be the thing talking, but that might also be an innocent, terrified person talking. So I was thinking about this film, and I was thinking you almost have to approach it the way you would a zombie film. The thing isn't a singular entity that this crew is up against. It's more like a zombie movie where the humans pose a dual-pronged threat. Like, any human being can be the thing, but human beings scared of the thing are every bit as dangerous as the thing itself. And it's worth mentioning that somebody who is shot in the fray in this film turns out to be a human. And that's obviously really harrowing for the crew. They have to come to grips with the fact that this might be murder, but they have to be so careful at the same time. And yeah, like Alex said, I think it's a lot more fun to just be along with the ride and not know and be scared, because they're scared, and rightfully so.
Now, the thing didn't just happen in 1982. It has kind of a history. It has a history in Hollywood. It has a history in literature that I think is pretty well known, but it's worth kind of repeating as we jump into the discussion of what The Thing 1982 means. Now, it was based on a novella called Who Goes There by John W. Campbell. And it had its admirers. It was well liked. It's a really interesting short story slash novella.
That's right. And the film does stick fairly close to this source material, closer than it sticks to the film that came after, but we'll get to that in a minute. Who Goes There begins with the discovery of a ship. There's no mention of the Norwegians, and the alien being has a couple of traits that are a little bit different. The alien being is telepathic. It's able to read minds and project thoughts, And the crew's attempt at finding a test to determine who is an alien and who is a thing fails. And in the end of the story, three survivors destroy all things and discover that one alien was working on an atomic-powered anti-gravity device that would allow it to escape to the wider world. So there's definitely a sense of normalcy being restored, pro-science, America wins, the threat was quashed, happy ending.
And then you move on to the 1951 film called The Thing from Another World, which was probably most notable for being produced by Howard Hawks. And, you know, at least according to IMDb, he was also an uncredited director on the film. And it very much falls in with the kind of atomic age 1950s American horror film. It's a guy in a suit. Essentially. And these kind of big sets and, you know, people in kind of like suits just running around saying, "Oh no, Dorothy, don't let the thing from another planet get you." And it has, you know, it has a very much a dated quality to it. It also has the pedigree of being associated with someone like Howard Hawks, who is a really prolific figure in Hollywood. And that's also kind of one of the reasons why John Carpenter would eventually kind of decide to get involved with it.
Mm-hmm. And John Carpenter famously was like, "I didn't want to make a creature film. I didn't want to have a film with somebody in a suit." And so his version of the film, which came out in 1982, is the one that we're going to talk about today. And obviously there was another remake slash prequel. It's so annoying to me to talk about, not because it's a remake. I mean, The Thing, 1982, is a remake, and I feel like that's always kind of worth, that's always one that I like to bring up when people are like, "Oh, remakes always suck." It's like, well, The Thing and The Fly, boom. I always do that. It's a prequel with the same name, which makes you think it's a remake, but it's not. It looks at what happened at the Norwegian station just before the events of the 1982 film. Norwegians discover ship, randomly invite American scientists to weigh in because Merca, and they fuck everything up also because Merca. So yeah, this film has a very long lineage, but John Carpenter wanted to stick to the source material but take his own spin on it. And to that end, he really assembled a dream team. And among that team is Rob Bottin, who was the special effects supervisor, and he was 22 years old at the time. He was 22. He had cut his teeth working on The Howling, which was the first ever cinematic person to werewolf transformation. It's something that from the beginning of horror, horror kind of grappled with, and for him to have pulled it off beautifully turned a lot of heads and got a lot of attention. So this 22-year-old comes up to John Carpenter and he's like, "Look, let's make it so that the alien be able to mimic and severed pieces of the alien to be able to reproduce that way. If a piece of it comes off, that piece can be a separate organism." And John Carpenter wasn't convinced. And so as an example, Bottin improvised the scene with the defibrillator and the man turning into a giant jaw, like recounting it from the point of view of the monster. He's like, "Okay, well, this guy's taking a defibrillator to me and I don't want him to. So my chest turns into a jaw and I cut off his arms and then my head goes back and then it falls off and then it sprouts legs." And it, he went through it all in that form, to which John Carpenter was just looking at him like, "Are you fucking kidding me? You gotta be fucking kidding me." And that turned into a line in the film at that moment. That's the origin of that line. So Rob Bottin had a lot to do with why this film is great. It is a technological marvel of special effects, of practical special effects. It really raised the bar and it holds up for the most part.
Oh, completely. I mean, it's one of those things that we touch on time and again in this podcast. You know, some of the films we pick because they are so singular and they're so influential, but they've never been truly mimicked. Mm-hmm. And I would say The Thing has that. It's kind of, you know, a magical confluence of so many different things that all come together. And yeah, it's the gory body horror. It's the beautiful shots. It's a really tight script. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, and to me, it's a John Carpenter film that doesn't feel like a John Carpenter film.
No.
No, it's very interesting. And, You know, I one of the first major pieces I ever wrote about horror was for Famous Monsters of Filmland, which I used to write for quite regularly. And so I pitched a story, I think, on the 30th anniversary of The Thing. So I wrote it in 2012, and it became the cover story.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
And your first piece of horror journalism went on the cover of fucking Famous Monsters?
Yeah, I mean, they added some supplementary pieces to it. And I just wrote this – I just pitched them an idea about, like, what about the kind of relevancy of The Thing 30 years on? They went for it. And I talked to a professor, E of T, about John Carpenter. And, you know, he was saying one of the kind of interesting things about Carpenter is you can look at him as a – horror director, an action director, and a sci-fi director. And that The Thing is kind of the perfect mix of all those things mm-hmm. that really speak to all of his interests, but he feels very much kind of out of the picture. Like, it doesn't feel like a John Carpenter film, maybe because it's a mixture of all of those things. And I actually like that viewpoint of it. And mm-hmm. I think you know, I'm not the biggest John Carpenter fan, but I like to think he was smart enough to know that he had enough good people working on this to kind of set up the shots, put it together in a way that made the most sense with the best people.
Yeah.
And it rose to such a level of, you know, I think near perfect cinema.
Yeah, I agree with that. I find his output really uneven to the point that it's hard to say you're a John Carpenter fan because what does that really mean? But this was a dream team and everything came together beautifully. And in so far as it wasn't received all that well right away, it was later on, which we'll get into.
Well, and one of the reasons why it wasn't received super well in many people's opinions, like when they were starting to make it and they were putting it together, one of the feelings was that, oh my God, Ridley Scott's Alien was such a huge success. It'll be just like that. It'll be huge. This is great. And then another small film, this little indie came out the same year called E.T. If anyone's heard of it. And that wound up dominating the box office of this family-friendly, heartstring-pulling Steven Spielberg joint that, you know, played to the masses. And that's not a bad thing, even though that movie fucking terrified me as a child. But that eclipsed The Thing. No one wanted to see, you know, certainly looking back on it, a lot of people are like, no, E.T. did this, so The Thing got eclipsed because it was gory, it was weird, it was a lot of men talking to each other. It wasn't mm-hmm. the kind of thing that people wanted at the time.
That's right. And John Carpenter has gone on record as being especially disappointed in the reception of this film because it was the horror fans who panned it as well. Cinefantastique magazine tried to dub it the most hated film of all time, and that really wounded John Carpenter. Like, negative press is one thing. He expected people to not be into the nihilism, to not be into the gore, but for the horror fans, he thought it would be a beautiful gift, and it is now. But it flopped so bad that it actually screwed him out of his next planned project, which was Stephen King's Firestarter, which wound up going to Mark L. Lester, for better or for worse. He claims the critics seized on the graphic violence in the monster, but I'm inclined to think it was the nihilism.
I agree. I think when you have a film that is a studio film that presents you with this kind of horrific view of mankind, I mean, the thing I kind of, in thinking about the nihilism of the film, which I have been, the thing it kind of reminded me most of in terms of reception and in terms of ideas and things like that was actually a film we talked about in our last episode, Darren Aronofsky's Mother,
mm-hmm.
that audiences rejected it.
This made me feel icky, and I don't like that.
And I was talking, you know, it was such a great thing to hear, Andrea, that you really liked it because it was something I really responded mm-hmm. to. And then I was talking to someone today about Mother, and they were like, I loved that movie. It was dark and fucked up, but I don't know why people didn't love it. And I was saying to him, I was like, I think, you know, give it 10 years, give it 20 years, and maybe we'll see this kind of turn with it. I'm not sure, but I think there's something that when you know, make that contract of going to the multiplex, you know, not a rep cinema, not a little like I went out on VOD and I found this film. And you have this kind of sense that the world can just end or your life can just end and it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I think that pisses people off.
That's not nectar for the masses, per se. And cinema was different back then. Like, if something flopped at the box office and the critics were panning it, it was shit. There was no, oh, I'll just give it a chance when it's on Netflix and I'm bored and I'm just skimming through. Like, there was no film festivals for it to ace, even if the mainstream critics panned it, which I think the case with Mother was celebrated in festivals?
It's a real mix.
It's divided.
Like, even premiered at TIFF, as far as I know, offhand. And even then, I was really interested in it, and I heard really mixed things coming out of TIFF.
Mm-hmm.
So.
God. Okay. I'd love to talk about that film all night.
But I think we will, based on your guys' feedback. That'll probably be an episode down the line. So, in the kind of intervening years between The Thing coming out and having a really rough go of it, and it becoming this beloved horror classic, cult classic, however you want to quantify it, there was some writing about The Thing, and this writing kind of influenced one of the major interpretations, one of the early interpretations of The Thing, that I feel like we would be remiss if we didn't at least mention it. I don't really subscribe to this reading of the film, but I do kind of understand it, and I want to throw it into the conversation and for your thoughts on it as a listener. So I kind of trace this theory back to a paper by Edward Guerrero called AIDS as Monster in Science Fiction and Horror Cinema, and that would be AIDS, the Autoimmune Disease. Now, it seems kind of a little bit too on the nose to label a thing as a kind of AIDS-influenced film. I mean, it was released in 1982, just at the kind of cusp of the AIDS crisis. It's about a group of men isolated on their own, and it involves blood tests.
Yeah.
And yeah, it just seems a bit too on the nose for it, but it does kind of take into consideration some of the underlying themes and fears that were going on at the time. And it is actually a really interesting paper. And some of the things that it kind of delves into is the fear and paranoia of the disease that doesn't reflect itself necessarily, especially for a long time, not until you're in the late stages of the disease, does it actually manifest in some kind of physical form.
Mm-hmm.
And so you often can't tell who your partner is and if they are infected or if they're not.
Or if you are infected.
Exactly. And so that kind of fear and paranoia was just kind of bubbling under the surface of culture, and especially within a marginalized community, that AIDS was kind of becoming an issue within the queer community, even though now we know not simply a queer issue.
Right. Right. I read that reading as well. I mean, obviously, paranoia can be applied in so many different directions. The original Thing from Another World is commonly understood to reflect 1950s McCarthyism, the Second Red Scare occurring immediately after World War II, preoccupied with communists, right? Your next door neighbor could be a commie. He could be an enemy of the state and right next door, and he looks like everybody else. It's terrifying. But McCarthyism had huge ramifications culturally, especially in Hollywood. It resulted in the blacklisting of creatives who were suspected of being closet communists and folding their commie rhetoric into their art. I'm sure we've mentioned this before. If we haven't before mentioned, You Must Remember This, another podcast about Hollywood history. They've got a great, great, great series on blacklisting in Hollywood. I think, was that the first one? I think that was the series you turned me onto it.
I think it was the Charles Manson one.
Yes, that one's also amazing.
Yeah, they're all pretty great.
But anyway, The Thing in 1982 more reflects the Reagan era, which was another time of paranoia and cynicism, and it has to do with the rise of the religious right and reactions against feminism and gay rights and so forth. So while I can see the allegory to AIDS, I almost read it more as the person living next to me could be so fundamentally different from me. And I think that's something that splintering of the average American has just snowballed since that time. And I think the internet has allowed groups to convene and develop, and you could be right next door to somebody who is fundamentally opposed to everything you're for. I feel like the AIDS allegory is also, again, pointing to the fact that there are no women among these guys. There are no female characters in this film save for the voice of the chess computer game, and maybe one of the dogs, we don't know.
That bitch.
That cheating bitch. Kurt Russell mentioned in a Rue Morgue interview on this film that there were no women on the crew either. So this was a sausage party through and through. The cast did a lot of team building exercises together. They had a whole lot of time to bro down, which is why their camaraderie is so natural. And it's definitely a big plus. Now, the fact that there are no women in this film comes up a lot when talking about this film, but I do not have a problem with it because, as we've talked about again in this podcast, we will take no women over a shoehorned in love interest, vapid female character who serves no other purpose other than to be a woman.
And if you really want to see the thing with some women who fill those kind of roles, watch the 2011 prequel.
Problematic. Problematic shoehorning in of women, but that's another episode.
And actually, I obviously was thinking a lot about the lack of women when we were approaching this episode because I knew it was something we had to talk about, and I have some thoughts that kind of spiraled me into other thoughts, but I did want to pull it back and talk about some stuff that really, I think, informed the choices without making a big deal about it.
Okay.
And that would be the exploration of the Antarctic. So the first landing in the Antarctic was apparently by Captain John Davis in 1821, even though that is considered contentious. Then you kind of enter into the late 19th century, what they call the heroic age of Antarctic exploration.
The heroic age.
Yeah, the Sausage Fest Exploration of the Antarctic, that one. And that really begins with Ernest Shackleton's Imperial Trans-Antarctic Expedition in 1919.
That's the first thing I thought of.
I know, right? There was a lot of, you know, when you think about the 60s, you can think of the space race, the race to get to the moon. Well, in the late 19th century, very early 20th century, it was the race to the poles, you know, the North and South Poles. So it became a focus of international explorers with a lot of people charting expeditions to explore the land. And it was a focus throughout Western science circles. There was a sense that the Antarctic could provide some kind of vast scientific and geographical importance in a lot of fields of research. Now, where we kind of bring it all back to the conversation we were just having, women were actually kept from exploring the Antarctic until the 1950s. There were actually legal barriers in place, aka sexism, that prevented them from joining these expeditions and doing research. Even then, it wasn't until the 60s, late 60s, that women were actually allowed on the land to do research. Mm-hmm. So this was really not a place where women had any dominion or had any place to be and feel safe and feel secure. So not only were these barriers of sexism, but a lot of the female explorers, and you can, you know, read up on quite a few of them. I fell down a little bit of a cave myself reading up about them, you know, experienced sexual harassment, I'm sure sexual assault, all of these kind of things going on in order to stake a claim on some research and, you know, follow the science that they were so passionate about.
Mm-hmm. But fast forward to the 80s, and Carpenter admits that the research they did on American outposts in the Antarctic at that time revealed that there were indeed women on those crews, but he omitted them from the outpost because he saw the alien threat as feminine. And I have a quote, "I thought it would be more interesting if the female presence was the creature, with all these men not willing to be taken over by it. But don't tell anyone that. It's a secret." Reading that quote, I felt like it wasn't what I wanted to hear. I mm-hmm. felt like I wanted to hear him say that there are no women on this crew because I didn't want there to be any bullshit sexual tension and Hollywood has these expectations and I just wanted to focus on the thing. I wanted to hear that it was because gender didn't matter and he didn't want to give in to Hollywood conventions. And I still think that's true at the end of the day. I think that the film is better for it, allowing these kind of authentic reactions. But yeah, how do you feel about the thing itself being a female presence?
I feel like I saw something on that, and a lot of people kind of allude to the scene with the defibrillator and the chest opens up and it becomes vaginal because any kind of gaping wound is apparently vaginal. I feel like people who don't have or don't see a lot of vaginas say that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That feels like such a weak response. But what I will say is a lack of women is it kind of, you know, it made me think of, let me down that train of thought that you had, like, okay, there was no bullshit romantic intentions. Like, could you imagine if there was a female on that crew and she was like, oh my God, I'm pregnant. What if the baby is a thing too, or
something
like that?
I'll protect you and I'll kill everyone else
and
in
then,
the process.
But the thing was, is like, the thing about the thing is that in so doing and so removing that kind of female presence within the film, this microcosm of humanity, this microcosm of Outpost 31 is truly frozen as they cannot generate. Mm. They cannot produce, and they really don't produce anything. They cannot produce another human due to the lack of women up there. They don't seem to do a lot of scientific research. Like, it's more kind of maintenance-y stuff.
Many times I've seen this film, I don't know what the fuck they're doing in the Antarctic.
It seems like they're there just to be there, like to guard the American outpost.
I get that sense, too, that they're just there for the long haul, almost like Jack Torrance in The Overlook.
Exactly. It's this kind of frozen in time thing. And then even, you know, rewatching the film, one of those moments that always kind of sticks out to me is when they're watching TV and then they go, oh, shit, I've seen this episode. So even their entertainment is recycled. They're mm-hmm. not doing anything new. Their food is not fresh. They're not kind of harvesting anything. They're not creating anything. They're not building anything. They're simply frozen.
They're stagnant.
Yeah. And so the arrival of this kind of quote-unquote thing forces them to act, if only to react. Mm. And their reaction causes the massive destruction of the base.
So you almost feel like it's an indictment of...
You know, I feel like...
Because that's feminist as fuck.
Yeah. It's, you know, I don't see a lot of other readings to it. They are simply there and they're kind of existing but not really living.
You know, I like
they're,
that.
They're not doing much with their time. And if they are doing anything, it's not clear.
Yeah. Well, no. I'll buy that for a dollar. I thought that the feminizing of the creature, I just attributed to the inevitable comparison to Alien, which is a very feminized creature. Harkening back to our Aliens episode, it's a very matriarchal creature. The only feminine presence we have in this film is really the voice of the chess machine.
Yeah, and that's Adrienne Barbeau, isn't it?
Is it really?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, that rules.
Yeah.
I think that scene is fantastic, and I think it's more meaningful every time I watch it. And it hit me one time. You know, TIFF shows some of these great horror classics in the dead of winter every year, and it's awesome. I caught the thing a couple of years ago, and I just had such a sense of cheating, bitch.
Yep.
And chess is a game that you cannot cheat at.
Mm-mm.
You can't. It's a game of strategy, and it's a game of fact. And it's not the game that they were playing on that base. So I thought it was interesting that that voice was the only overtly feminine voice in the bunch.
Well, and think about it. Like, if they won, if they'd figured out, okay, this person is infected, we kill them, fine, done. What happens? They only go back to the way they knew. So they go back to being inactive in so many ways. So it's this kind of, you know, I think the thing is the alien being the thing is something really jarring that throws a wrench into everything around them. And it shows that there's a really, really brilliant book, and it's called Horror Noir. And it's by Robin R. Means Coleman. And it's about the black culture and history in horror films. And she writes a little bit about the thing, and she writes about the discrepancy of, you know, this kind of base that is supposed to be, you know, all men and this camaraderie, like you were just talking about the team building. But there is a sense that there is a discrepancy between the two black characters and everyone else.
Right.
So that would be Childs and Knowles as the two black characters. And she writes about them having the kind of more service jobs rather than a scientist or a helicopter pilot or anything like that. Mm. And that even Childs, he has a lot of the same qualities as MacReady. And Childs is labeled as a hothead and someone who can't be put in charge and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, it's him and MacReady who are left, and you don't know who's coming out on top. It's interesting because she comes at it, and it really speaks to a lot of the stuff in the film where, you know, you expect these people to have this bond. Mm-hmm. We're up there in the Arctic. We're up there for God knows how long. So let's all just try to get along and be buds and do what we have to do while we're up here, whatever that is. And the kind of bonds fall away so quickly that it's – they you see their superficiality.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole book, Horror Noir, is so brilliant. And I think she writes 3 or 4 pages about the thing, and they're some of the most interesting analysis I've ever read on it. So if you are interested, do track that book down.
So I'm glad that you bring up the leadership aspect, because the leadership of this group is an interesting issue. You've got Commander Gary, who is obviously in charge, and in the beginning, he kind of wields that authority with the gun. The gun is the equivalent to the conch in Lord of the Flies. He who has the gun controls the means, and at one point, he surrenders that.
I guess you'll all feel a little easier if somebody else was in charge.
He surrenders it, and Norris, who is second in command, turns down leadership when offered. So in this scenario of the thing, you've got a situation where leadership of the compound is one thing, but a crisis situation and a survival situation requires a different kind of leadership. And that's where we see MacReady emerge as a reluctant hero. And a reluctant hero is not to be confused with the anti-hero. The anti-hero does not possess heroic qualities like courage or morality. We're talking about someone like Mad Max, who is the hero, but he's basically acting out of his own self-interest. The reluctant hero is Die Hard's John McClane. The reluctant hero is pulled into the leadership by rising to the occasion, and he has doubts and misgivings about his actions that really make him relatable.
Yeah, I think the call to leadership is a really strange facet to have in your personality, to kind of be that alpha or type A that sees that leadership needs to happen and to jump on it rather than to have it thrust upon you is such an interesting trait. And I think it's very expected of men and very confusing in women within the society that we're in. And, you know, I think MacReady, there is a void. And he has the means in terms of his skill set of being a helicopter pilot to jump in there and say, these are the calls I'm going to make. You know, even when they talk about going to the Norwegian base and they're worried about the storm, but they jump on it and they go anyway. He's an interesting figure because he's mean. He's not necessarily a likable guy. I think any likability of MacReady kind of comes from the fact that it's Kurt Russell.
Right. He's so lovable.
Oh my God.
But there's like two elements to leadership. First of all, there's the willingness to take on the responsibility of making those calls. And then the other element is other people following his lead. And for the most part, this group is made up of varied characters who have different personalities that come into play. For the most part, they are willing to follow him, except for Childs, who is just kind of like, who died and made you leader? Are you willing to shoot me? Fucking let's go. And I really like how this film includes that it's not a clear chain of command, that we're not just following Superman into the void. There's a problematic leader at stake, and ultimately it's not a happy ending.
Well, and he's, you know, a problematic leader not only because of his ways and means, but because in this situation there is no way to trust anyone. There is no way to know for sure who is a thing and who is not. Even though they do the blood test, it all goes to shit so quickly after that that you can't truly know who is and who is not a thing.
That's right. And he does make some questionable calls, particularly that scene where he's got the dynamite, who's just like, put down your weapons or I'm going to blow us all up. It's like, well, you might be the thing, man. If it was any of us, they'd be tied up, but the rules are different for you, but ultimately they defer because this is such an impossible situation where the decisions are all wrong, even if they're right.
And I think in so many situations, when you have this character in film or in a novel or in a TV show, whatever it is, they need to exist because if they didn't, there would be no narrative drive. You would be sitting in the static space of men yelling at each other, and that's just Twitter.
That's right. And I truly feel like all of these characters are very relatable. Nobody really does anything that I couldn't imagine someone doing or myself even doing.
And, you know, one of the things that struck me, so the last time I saw this was in between Christmas and New Year's, and I went to the, I guess, almost annual screening of the thing at TIFF, and they had one of the original prints, and they screened that, and it was absolutely incredible to watch it and to really feel with a whole audience there how bizarrely comical the blood test scene is.
Yeah.
the kind of like shaking, the nervous glances, the quick cuts to them all being tied up.
I know you gentlemen have been through a lot. And when you find the time, I'd rather not spend the rest of this winter tied to this fucking couch!
There are some amazing comic beats in this film. And, you know, this has those elements to it when you almost have to kind of give yourself up to the narrative thrust of the film. And the filmmakers and everyone involved were smart enough to know how to play that. So it creates yet another beat, another texture, another layer to this film, which really help elevate it. So kind of speaking on the nature of leadership and the inability to trust the people around you, I wanted to talk a little bit about paranoia in film. And I came across an article we'll link in the show notes. It's by a writer named George Weed. And he writes about this term filmnoia or film paranoia. And he attributes a lot of his kind of writing about it to a lot of the gangster films of the 30s, 40s, even 50s. Kind of takes it through a bunch of different stages, but I think it totally works with a lot of horror films. And he brings up a lot of really interesting points, and he kind of delineates certain things that paranoia needs to exist in the real world or off screen. And those things are, it thrives within an environment of moral chaos, increasing loneliness, imagining an outside pressure that is aimed at this person or persons. And the oppressors are often anonymous, and the person dealing with paranoia in the real world often feels that they are the only ones who can overcome them. Now, Weed goes on to explore paranoia as it's kind of dealt with in film, and they're quite similar but a bit different. So in film, paranoia needs an environment of mental or social chaos, single-minded, lonely heroes, a story involving unheroic defeat or inexplicable death, dark impersonal antagonists, or a refusal of true catharsis. And if that's not a kind of step-by-step narrative to this film, then I don't know what is.
Absolutely. That must have been in Carpenter's back pocket.
Yeah, I'm, you know, like to think so. But where film paranoia or film noia becomes important for Weed is when an audience is asked to understand the paranoid's point of view, the audience is then therefore thrown into a moral limbo, because in most of our everyday lives, we might experience a modicum of paranoia, mm-hmm. like, oh God, does my boss hate me? Oh no, is my partner cheating on me? Ugh, did I say something to that friend who now doesn't like me? Anything like that, but it rarely gets to the stage of like, I need to do something really horrific and terrible to deal with this paranoia. And I think in having film noia or film paranoia, you've got this kind of window into what it is. And I think, Andrea, just as you were saying, the different characters and the fact that even though there are so many of them, they're quite well drawn and they each have their own characteristics. So you kind of see this paranoia through several different lenses. You've got, you know, giving up the gun. You've got the kind of reluctant hero. You've got Childs, who is, you know, very similar to MacReady in so many ways. So you've got a lot of different entry points. But I think through all the different entry points, any one of us has a way to say, I think I'd handle it like that. I think I'd handle it like that. And that's what you really want out of a film. I think films and stories are ways to deal with the things that we don't deal with or that we're scared to deal with. So this offers a really precise viewpoint.
That's right. And so many zombie films and so many disaster films that fall upon humans to make impossible choices, there's that fatal flaw. Mm-hmm. There's somebody makes a mistake or somebody is a complete asshole.
Yeah.
And their shortcomings are the downfall of the entire group. That is not present in The Thing. I feel like everybody did everything right. Somebody mm-hmm. had to make really hard choices, and innocent people got killed because they weren't willing to go along with the new orders, such as it was. And as a result, everything was just still fucked up, which is the nihilism of the film, but also the greatest depiction of pure paranoia.
And there's not an essence to the alien where there is, you know, you're infected and you grow fangs. You're not a vampire. It changes each and every time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think the inclusion of the opening shot where the saucer, like the actual ship saucer thing, crashes in the Antarctic, you know, there's so much that we can pull out of it that we don't know. So I believe Carpenter and Rob Bowden and all of these people have talked about, you know, the thing is really different because it has subsumed so many other alien cultures and things like that. So it can take on so many different shapes. Mm-hmm. So there is an inherent unknowability of this monster.
That's right.
And it is terrifying.
And it's reflected in the fact that these are really casual working class men. You get the sense that they're friends and they speak very plainly to one another. And when they're up against something that's so abstract and abject and indefinable, they're saying stuff like, I guess it mimics us on a cellular. I don't fucking know. What do you want from me? Which is exactly how you'd approach something like this. Nobody makes an outlandish claim that they can't back up. These are just real people doing the best they can.
And in doing the best they can, they do things like lock up the doctor.
Yeah.
You know, who at one point you see him again. It's another interesting comic beat, like a really darkly comic beat where he's got the noose in the background.
I love that.
No one says anything. It's just there.
Yeah.
And you have a sense constantly through the visuals, through the dialogue, of the extreme situations these people are put in. And again, when you're put into extreme situations, your character is really tested. And it's what you do and what you don't do. And the greatest thing about The Thing is how likable and relatable these characters are.
Yeah.
Because you kind of want them all to live, and you feel bad when something bad happens to them.
Or when something doesn't happen to them on screen, which brings us to the ending. The contested, oft-debated ending. I love the ending. According to the interview that I read, which, incidentally, I can't help but throw a plug in here, Rue Morgue issue 72 was the 10th anniversary of the magazine, and it was a Halloween double issue, and it is all things The Thing. There's an interview with John Carpenter, with Rob Bottin, with Kurt Russell, and Keith David. They're all in there. It's a great issue. It's tons of insight into this amazing film. So according to Carpenter, Universal was putting pressure on him to end the film with the explosion of the outpost. Outpost is destroyed. Who knows what happened? But the little exchange that happens between MacReady and Childs after the fact is not only the better narrative ending, but gave birth to a lot of theories about how the story actually ended.
And I'll say this, like, so we'll talk about the theories right now. I personally have a favorite theory.
Tell me.
Well, we'll get through them, and then you can guess which one is
okay,
my favorite.
Okay.
There is probably, I think, the most famous one would be the JB bottle theory, the Jim Beam bottle theory, which MacReady is kind of carrying around at the beginning of the film, and he's got at the end of the film.
Mm-hmm.
So he, you know, the fact that he offers Childs a drink, and there's a line earlier on in the film when someone's like, we should prepare our own food. We should mm-hmm. eat out of cans. Mm-hmm. So the sharing of the bottle represents the thing spreading itself.
Yep.
There's also the breath theory. Uh-huh. So at the end, you've got MacReady and you see his breath. And that's supposed to represent that he's still human. And Childs, you don't see his breath.
Right.
So that's another possible indicator that maybe he's the thing.
Uh-huh.
And there's been a lot of conjecture of, like, that's shot in a certain way, or there's this, there's that. And then there is the eye gleam theory. And this kind of came about during the Blu-ray release of The Thing, when the cinematographer mentioned, seemingly an offhand remark, but there's the sense that when a character was the thing, they wouldn't light the eyes. So there's darkness on the eyes, and it's most clearly seen, and the cinematographer references it, within and around the blood test scene with the character Palmer. So the shadow actually casts down on his eyes, so they don't light. There's just darkness. There's shadow on them, so they don't reflect any light. And that's supposed to kind of represent that, oh, this is a hint that this character is infected by the thing. And they kind of go on to explain that it's actually really interesting, because when Palmer very shortly thereafter turns into the thing Palmer, his eyes are some of the first things to kind of pop and explode and be really gooey and gross. So those are the three main theories that I've tracked down. And
I'm gonna go with the bottle theory.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love a good callback. Anything that gets brought up at the beginning of the film and then it returns later on, and maybe it's a big deal, maybe it's a small deal, but there's something about that bottle which feels so important.
I heard another theory about that bottle, which is that MacReady actually hands him a bottle of Molotov cocktail that he unthinkingly drinks, therefore proving that Childs is the thing.
What?
Impossible to prove. I read some speculation that, yeah, you can see MacReady's breath, but he was just running, whereupon Child was not so much. But there is so much speculation. Ultimately, at the end of the day, the film ends with MacReady's seminal line.
Why don't we just wait here for a little while? See what happens.
And that was Kurt Russell's line, and it's a beaut.
It's like a line out of Waiting for Godot. I'm pretty sure that is a line out of Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot.
Again, it's such a great callback all the way to the beginning when he is mad at that chess program. You cheating bitch. He accuses it of cheating, which it absolutely could not have been, and he destroys it. That's such a character trait glimpse into him where he's just like, if I can't win, then nobody wins. And that's exactly the note that the film ends on, and I adore it.
Mm-hmm. And there's no hill I'm going to die on with the ending to this.
Absolutely not.
I think ultimately I like the kind of blankness of the ending.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's so ambitious and it's so unique, but I am a sucker for film theories and stuff like that. So
that's fun.
Yeah, it's fun. So we have mentioned the prequel, the 2011 prequel, again, very confusingly named The Thing. I had started watching it so many times and never finished it. And then I watched it for this episode and I totally stand by my viewpoint of never finishing it. It's a slog.
But you still haven't finished it?
No, I finished it. But I kind of wish I hadn't. It's such a slog, and it's strange because I actually don't think the idea is that terrible.
No, I agree with that. I agree. I think the story is well-formed. I liked the way it set up the events of the 1982 film. I like the way it ended with the Norwegian chasing a dog. I like the way it wrapped up that two-faced corpse with a nice bow. I am not opposed to a prequel, but this one shit the bed.
It was just so, like, rote. There was nothing interesting or special or unique about it. And I think that's something you have to be really careful of when you're doing a film that kind of relies heavily on a scene from a previous film. Like, yes, you have to set up all these things, but they get to it in the most basic way possible. And the inclusion of the female lead, who's played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
Bless her heart. It's not her fault.
Yeah, no, it's not her fault. And she's really trying, and it's just so clear that they were like, oh, remember Aliens? Remember Ripley?
Totally. 100%, I agree with that. I feel like the first film, it doesn't take a really pro-American stance,
mm-hmm.
whereas the prequel, I felt like, you know, the Norwegians had something, but they had to call in the big guns, which is to say the American. And then it's manifested in this scientist who, you know, puts his research before all else. And, you know, that's just, we don't need to see this as Americans trying to clean up the mess the Norwegians made.
And speaking of cleaning up messes, I found the IMDb trivia really interesting on that film because they shot an ending and then they hated it, so they just CGI'd over the ending. So you've got this weird, like, CGI mess at the end of the film that they literally just stuck CGI over something they had already CGI'd.
Okay, so you're talking about the part where they actually enter the UFO, which to me I think is a turning point where the film just goes really wrong. You don't need to go in there. That's just an opportunity to flex some crazy CGI and make things look really cool. And they even fucked that up because there's an entity within the ship that is stupid pixelated. That's what you're talking
about. Yeah, it looks like a game of Tetris.
I mean, what's that thing even supposed to be, first of all?
Well, from what I remember of the IMDb trivia, that they shot an ending. It was another alien entity who had survived the thing that was like, oh my God, in alien language, the thing is evil, beware. And the studio heads, when they saw that, were like, oh, we hate that. So just cut up all the shots, use some of them, and just put some CGI over the alien that you CGI'd. And it can be like a thing. It can be a thing. So that's why you see this kind of mess of pixels. And I watched it with my boyfriend, and he was like, something's really wrong with this. And I was like, yeah, it looks like pixels. Looks like Tetris.
Not only does it look like shit, but it is so narratively unnecessary.
Yeah, and that's what he was saying. He was like, no, there's a narrative. Like, there's something really wrong. And then I read it, and I was like, holy shit, baby, you're right. So, yeah, it's Again, I almost wish there was a remake of the prequel. Can that be a thing?
It can definitely be a thing. Anything is possible in this thing.
Anything with a thing, yeah. If you're not calling it the thing, could be possible. Please, if someone makes a remake and is listening to this, don't call it the thing. Call it something else.
Call it the thing. The prequel. The prequel.
The prethinquel.
Great. I'll take that over than the exact same title. It's so confusing.
It's a strange, boring mess of a film to me anyway. Again, if you like it, like, fuck, I wish I loved it, but I don't.
There are things to like about it.
No, please list them.
I cannot. I did like the way it's set up for the next film.
But how, like, after you're slogging through that film and you get to the end and you're like, yeah, okay, there needs to be, like, the dog needs to get away. Then the original score kicks in and you're like, fuck, yes! And then it ends and you're like, no!
Now I want to watch the real movie.
Yeah.
But we don't have any culmination to the Mary Elizabeth Winstead character, so who knows, there might be a sequel to the prequel that's not the thing. I don't fucking know. I did like the way she dispatched with her partner slash potential love interest slash guy from It Comes at Night.
Yeah. Joel Edgerton?
I liked the way she just dispatched with him. Was like, get out of the helicopter because I'm about to blowtorch your ass and you're not fucking up my ride.
Yeah.
That's the best I can do with it, and that's being pretty generous. But
I know there was, I believe, a video game of the thing. The original of the 1982,
yeah.
Sorry, not the original.
But, I was intrigued by it because it was supposedly all about paranoia, all about being in that crew and ascertaining who among you is an imposter.
And then even more recently, there was a board game, right?
Yeah, have you played it?
I have not.
I played it twice, technically, but only once in reality because it is really confusing. First of all, to set the stage, this is a beautiful, beautiful board game. This was a collaboration with USopoly, who makes board games like no one else, and they're very inclined to tie in film franchises. They're the ones responsible for The Walking Dead, Clue, and the Garfield Monopoly, and whatever the fuck they can mash together, they will. But they collaborated with Mondo, who does amazing horror movie artwork, and they got my good friend, actually, Justin Erickson, they got him to design the box and the cards and the game board and all of that shit. He helped sculpt the little pieces. He was involved from day one. And so he actually came over to play it with us at Rue Morgue. And we put the Ennio Morricone soundtrack on vinyl and played it while we played. And Justin explained it to us. And we were like, what the fuck?
And you play a lot of games.
I play a lot of games, and yeah. I feel like I know game logic, but this game is really different in that there's so many ways to play. There's the actual bare bones of the game, which involves someone emerging as the leader, and the leader picks a mission, and the mission will be something like, the kitchen's on fire. We need to go put out the fire in the kitchen, and they need to assemble a crew. And verbally, players of the game have to seduce the captain into being like, well, I've got a fire extinguisher and I can be very helpful with that. And then the player who is playing the captain of that particular mission has to choose their people and go take care of it. But someone might be the thing. And that's a card that you draw in secret.
Oh, so it's like a really elaborate murder wink.
Sort of.
Can we just play murder wink?
And if you are the thing, it's up to you if you want to help the survivors survive, if you want to infect, if you want to be covert, if you want to be sneaky. You can choose to lie. You can choose to play honestly. And 9 times out of 10, nobody survives that goddamn game. But holy shit, is it fun.
Yeah.
The learning curve is insane. I'm hopeful that now it's been out long enough that somebody's made a really pithy, articulate 10-minute YouTube video that can introduce you to the game.
Oh, Jesus, 10
as
minutes?
Opposed to the quasi-drunken 40-minute fractured spiel we got from Justin. Bless his heart if you're listening to this. I had a blast that night. But this game was not easy to learn, but I would still wholeheartedly recommend it if you're a fan of the film. It really does convey the situation.
That already sounds exhausting.
I just have to buy it. I want to play it right now. It sounds exhausting to you, and I'm like, man, I need to conquer it.
I think that's it. That's our episode on The Thing. And Of course, the conversation doesn't end with this episode. There's so much scholarship on this film, blog posts, articles, interpretations.
You name it.
Infographs, YouTube videos. We're going to link some of them in the show notes as episodes so you can check them out for yourselves. But this actually isn't a bit. There is an extreme cold alert on for Toronto right now. Minus 20 tonight, dude. But that all to say, this was a good time of year to do this episode because I have been feeling cold and holed up with very few people. Yeah. So thankfully they're not murderers
feeling
or things.
Paranoid?
What? No, you're paranoid. Stop it, Andrea. Okay. Stop trying to hug me.
So that's it for us for this month, but next month is another month.
Oh boy, is next month ever another month? So we're going to pick up something. We're going to pick up something that we kind of just like placed to the side, and we're like, oh, we'll come back to it.
Yeah, we'll see in a bit.
And this was something that since the last time we tackled this topic, it has really come back in culture, in mm-hmm. horror culture, in popular culture, and that is witches.
Yeah.
We're going to do witches. We're going to do witches part 3. And we're going to tackle some of the newer films on the figure of the witch. So, of course, we will be talking about The Witch
mm-hmm.
and The Autopsy of Jane Doe.
Right. Which, you know, we were so conflicted. I think that came out right when we were doing Volume 2. One of those movies came out right when we were recording Volume 2. And
yeah.
we were like, fuck. Why couldn't this have been a couple of months sooner? And furthermore, we were wondering if calling The Autopsy of Jane Doe a witch movie wasn't in itself a spoiler.
And I felt really weird because I refer to, and I think not this last episode, the last assessment episode, but the assessment episode of 2016, I referred to secret witch movies. Films
yeah,
that purport to be about one thing but are actually holy shit about witches.
Uh-huh.
Oh my God. And I mentioned this, and a lot of people were like, what are those films? And I was like, I don't know if I can say those films because I'm worried it'll be a spoiler. But holy shit, sorry, guys. Spoiler?
It's not.
I don't think it's a spoiler.
I don't think it's a spoiler unless it takes something away from what you're watching. And that mystery, the way it unfolds, for it to get from point A to point B, it's all about the journey.
And it's it really is. I think it's such a brilliant film. I've seen it a couple times now. I reviewed it for Rue Morgue, and I'm really excited to revisit it. I'm really excited to revisit both of these films and to talk about them and to talk about where we are now with the figure of the witch.
Yeah, and to draw on everything we've talked about before. I feel like every single episode we do on witches has something new to contribute to the discussion.
So until next time, Andrea and I are just going to sit in the Rue Morgue vault with this bottle of JMB in this minus 20 degree weather with Andrea's ripped up long johns, which are weird.
And we're just going to see how it goes.
And until next time, office hours are closed.